Let's go to 2 Timothy, please. What I'd like to do in Timothy tonight is something a little different. I'd like to give you a little overview of the book. And I'd like to point out personalities in the book, people. For example, in chapter 1, you most definitely have Timothy. Paul writes, "To Timothy, my dearly beloved son," verse 2. And of course, you have Paul. Paul is mentioned all the way through this book. In chapter 1, he talks about verse 11, "Unto which I am appointed a preacher and an apostle and a teacher to the Gentile of the Gentiles, for which cause I also suffer these things." Okay, Paul is here. In chapter 4, he talks about, in verse 7, "I have fought a good fight, I have finished my course, I have kept the faith." He mentions himself off and on through this book. His sufferings, his calling, his credentials, he's an apostle, the work of the apostle, his stewardship of the gospel. Then Timothy is in the book. And Timothy is mentioned various times through the book. In fact, I'm greatly convinced that the purpose of 2 Timothy is to encourage man to continue on in God's work. I'm more and more convinced that the whole purpose of the book is to encourage this man to step out and do what he had been doing before. Things come into our lives that cut away at our faith and our dedication and our service in such a way that we often tend to put things on the back burner. And God wants Paul to bring him up and turn the fire up. He says, verse 6, "Wherefore I put thee in remembrance to stir up the gift of God, which is in thee by the putting out of my hand. Stir it up, add fuel to the fire. Get this thing going, get it burning brightly." Something had happened. And then you'll find in chapter 1 also, in verse 15, two men by the name of Phygellus and Hermogenes. Don't know anything about these guys. Other than what is right here, as far as I know, I can't find anything else about them. But two men who are mentioned, and they're mentioned in a negative way. Something happened in these men's lives, and Paul wrote them, and the tragedy of it is we know nothing about them. We know nothing about their dedication or service. We know nothing about what they accomplished. But all we have here for a historical record is that these men turned away when the action and going got rough. And then you have another man in chapter 1, verse 16, Onesiphorus. Another man. Very little is known about him. But the things that are said about him are so dynamic and powerful. You have a contrast all the way through. And then in chapter 4, there are many other characters mentioned. But I specifically want to refer to chapter 4, verse 10, to Demas. "For Demas hath forsaken me, having loved this present world, and is departed unto Thessalonica." Now, if you read the book, I would like to suggest this. If you read the book in one setting, you'll notice that Paul uses the word ashamed quite frequently. You'll notice that Paul is talking as someone who has trusted God and knows God is faithful and knows what God can do, but that there have been people around him who have struggled with certain things, and if some have made it and some haven't. And the way I take it from Timothy is that Timothy was discouraged. I take it that Timothy had reached a place where he was re-evaluating, thinking through some of the dedication, some of his calling, some of the jobs, some of the things that God gave him to do. In other words, he was at a position where he was being faced with a new set of challenges. Now remember, when Paul wrote this, this is Paul's last letter. Paul had been in prison twice, released once to go off, and now he's in jail, and at this time he's in jail, there's no confidence of release. When he writes the letter to the Philippians, the first time he's in jail, he's completely sure he's going to be released. He just has that confidence and assurance. But right here he doesn't have that. "I have fought a good fight, I have finished my course, henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness." And Paul is a man who had been asked time and time again by his own heart and by the world around him to compromise. And as a dying man on death row, there is no looking back, no discouragement, there is no regret. There is confidence that he will be with the Lord. But Timothy isn't in that position. Timothy is in a position of decision. And if you read it, you'll find that Paul is constantly reminding Timothy and urging him and encouraging him and challenging him. And much of what he says to Timothy is to get him to work, to move, to trust the Lord again. Remember, Timothy's travel with Paul. This is at the end of Paul's life. Timothy has been out there with the team of workers. He's been traveling the empire with Paul. He's been moving from place to place. He has seen assemblies started. He knows the power of God. And yet when you read this letter, you just sense that everything is not right in the man's thinking at this time. And Paul says a lot of things to encourage him. When he says, stir up the gift that is in thee, verse 6. There seems to be that reminder. Verse 5, he tells him of his background. Your faith has always been genuine, verse 5. When I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith, you've always had a genuine, real faith. I've never been able to feel your faith was cheap. I've known your faith, and I'm just reminding you that unfeigned faith that was in your mother, that was in your grandmother, and that would be in you. And he talks about this later on. He's reminding him of the genuineness of faith, the people who taught him. And he said, stir up the gift that is in you. And in verse 7 he says, for God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power, love, and a sound mind. See, right here he's telling him that God has given him the necessary tools to do the work that God's asked him to do. And he reminds him. I like the way he puts this. For example, he says in verse 7, he has not given us the spirit of fear. Why does he say that? He's not given the spirit of fear. Very possibly because that's what Timothy was going through. Fear. Perhaps the fear of falling away. When you see other people cave in, you might have that fear yourself. You have not been given the spirit of fear, but you've been given the spirit of power. This word power means here enablement and strength. It does not mean running around and putting on sideshows and having everybody come in and watch you do razzle-dazzle, dynamic spiritual things. That is not what it means. You have not been given the spirit to put on spiritual sideshows. He's talking about you've been given the spirit for enablement. The word means enablement or strength. All right? This is what Timothy was lacking. Strong words of encouragement from one who has found strength in God's will. This is what Paul is giving. Somebody who knows that the Spirit can strengthen you. And I want to tell you, Timothy, remember this. You're forgetting some basic things. Number one, your discouragement has made you set aside some of your abilities. Number two, you are forgetting that God is able to enable us for every situation. The Spirit has been given to us, remember, for enablement and strength, and then for love. I've just got a question written down. Could it be that Timothy was drawing back from love when he saw how badly Paul had been handled? Could it be that Timothy was having a few problems about giving himself to other people as he saw how other people that had been dedicated were handled and treated? Could it be that Timothy was going through a time when he wondered if it was worth giving his life to spread the gospel and tell other people, especially when the world was handling Christians in such a rough way? Very possibly. It's a question I pose as I read this. Then you are given the spirit of a sound mind, of discipline. Why does Paul say that? Had not Timothy been thrown off balance? Perhaps. Just a little off balance. Thing just a little out of little distortion. And so he says of a sound mind, God calls you, Timothy, and he has enabled you, and he has given you what you need. And remember, you can think clearly. You can think these matters through clearly. the enemy will not keep you off balance. So these are a little background of Timothy, you see. Timothy is going through a particular problem, and all the way through the letter, he's reminded, and the word ashamed keeps coming up. I am not ashamed, Paul says in verse 12. I am not ashamed. You see, I suffer for this, and I am not ashamed. And he goes on and he talks about this in verse 16. See, Onesiphorus was not ashamed of my chain. And so on in chapter 2, verse 15. A workman that needed not be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. So this word keeps coming up, and I really feel that what was happening is here is the five people who I mentioned in this chapter and Demas in the last chapter all have to do with the idea of being ashamed. Some suggestions that I'd like to throw out to you then. So what you have is a very interesting thing. Now what about these people? Paul is close to death. Timothy is a younger man who needs to be worked with. Phygellus and Hermogenes, two men who deserted Paul. Why did they desert him? Verse 15, and this thou knowest, that all they who are in Asia turned away from me, of whom are Phygellus and Hermogenes. And then in verse 16 he talks about Onesiphorus and being ashamed. Is it something happened to these men? That they became ashamed? That when the opportunity came to step out, these men found it difficult and they decided to turn and to go back where it was safer. And then let's just glean a few things from this. I'm just gleaning thoughts. In chapter 1, there are some interesting thoughts in verse 11 and 12. Under which I am appointed a preacher and an apostle and a teacher of the Gentiles, for which cause I also suffer these things. Nevertheless, I am not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed, and am persuaded that he's able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day. Now there definitely is the idea here that Paul said God keeps on deposit all of my spiritual deposit. He knows and he keeps record of it. I am not ashamed, and I know that he's able to keep them. Nothing is lost. God knows all and he understands all. And certainly Paul is talking about the salvation of his soul. Should the sword come to my head any day, I am able to rest in him. He's able to keep that. I have committed my soul to him eternally. And he's able to keep it even in the time when death comes. He will bring it to himself. And his commitment to preach and defend the truth, he was also sure that God was able to enable him to be faithful to his calling in spite of sufferings. I believe that's another thing he's getting at. In spite of the sufferings and in spite of the problem, God is able to give me the strength that I need in spite of my sufferings. He is able to keep that which I've committed to him, my dedication, my heart. I have committed my heart to him. And I have said, take it and use it and develop it and conform it to the image of your Son. And I believe he is able to keep that unto him against that day. And I'd like to suggest this. This is just a suggestion, because it might be a little interpretation out of the ordinary. I like to do this when I read the scripture. When I get in here, I like to just, you know, I figure I've got nothing to lose by asking these questions. But I would like to suggest another idea from Paul, and it's this. Maybe he's talking against that day, not only the day of his death, but perhaps the day of trial when he would be tempted to back down. Perhaps the day when he would be in a situation and he could speak boldly, but he would not, because he would be weighing all of the opportunities around him to see whether they were in his favor or not. Perhaps against that day when I, like Phygellus and Hermogenes, will return to the world. That day, like Demas, when I will say, I love the Lord, but I love my life, and I'm not going to give it yet. The day when I will weigh everything and say, is it in my favor to witness or isn't it? Is it in my favor to give my life to Christ or is it not? And I would like to suggest tonight that one of the things he means is simply that. That day, the day of trial when he would be tempted to break down, the day when he would feel ashamed and would draw back and remain silent. The day when the enemy would say, you better watch out. You know if you keep talking like that, what it's going to cost you. And perhaps that's what he means also. Against that day, because look how he talks about being ashamed. That's why I pointed out all these characters. Look how he talks about Timothy. And right away in verse 12 he says, I am not ashamed. See, he is able to keep that. He is able to guard me. He's able to keep me from that day when I would back down. And then he talks about men who back down. See? He talks about two men who've turned and backed down. Two men who, for some reason or the other, weighed the situation and said, not now, later, but not now. So they drew back. But then he brings in another man here that is of great encouragement. Onesiphorus. One of these people you really hear so little about. The word means, verse 16, the house of Onesiphorus. It actually means, literally means to bring profit. And that the man did. He was a disciple in Ephesus. He apparently had known Paul in Ephesus. It says in verse 18, he ministered unto me at Ephesus many times. When Paul had traveled through Ephesus, Onesiphorus and his house were open to minister to him. But you see what's happening now is that the grand day of the missionary movement is now starting slowly to wane. I don't mean that missionary movement stopped, but the glory of it. Now they were paying the price. Well, there were problems before. But at one time they tramped through the Roman Empire going and establishing assemblies, and except for a few local riots here or there or a few local leaders, they were untouched. But you see, now the wrath of the government's coming down on them. Now Nero and other people who are there are beginning to come down on them. Beginning to squeeze them. And so what you have now is, once it was great and glorious to be part of that missionary troop, was great and glorious to be identified. Perhaps Hermogenes and Phagellus felt that way. Greatly to be identified. Demas. And we'll talk about him in a minute. He's a very interesting character. Very greatly misunderstood. So, Onesiphorus is interesting, and it says this, for he oft refreshed me and was not ashamed of my chain. There's that word ashamed again. See? Paul said in verse 8 to Timothy, be not thou ashamed, therefore ashamed of the testimony of our Lord. Is it fair to say that Timothy was starting to sit and weigh it out? I believe he was. I believe he was at a point of decision about particular matters of dedication. So Paul talks about, he isn't ashamed, says in verse 12, I'm not ashamed. I have committed my soul, I have committed my life, I have committed my dedication, I have committed it all to him. And he's able to keep it against that day, the day of my death, the day when I will be tempted to back down. And then he brings in a couple men who did, but he brings in another man who didn't. Onesiphorus, look at him. He wasn't ashamed of my chain, Timothy. But when he was in Rome, he sought me out very diligently and found me. Now, I've probably mentioned this before. I'm sure I have you. But this means exactly what he said, sought me out diligently. Can you imagine? Here's a man on death row. He's dying because he is identified with a movement that the government now feels is a danger to him. And the man is a danger to him. The man has become a danger to not only the government, but the religion. And other people have stood there and made a decision, should I get close to him or shouldn't I? Just like when the Lord was on trial. But here's Onesiphorus, and he comes to Rome, he starts knocking on our jail doors. Bang, 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 bang. And the leader of the jail comes, what do you want? You got a guy here by the name of Paulus Tarsus? No, okay. Bang, bang, bang. Walking around, diligently seeking out. Saul of Tarsus here. Yeah, he's a preacher. He's the guy who's preaching Jesus Christ. Yeah, he's in here. And he went in and he refreshed him. It's something else. It's really something. And the word Paul uses here for refreshing means to cool off. Literally means to cool off. And it's interesting, isn't it? He just brought real refreshment to me. Just as one who brings a glass of cold water or in a fever just cools you off. Just a tremendous refreshment has been brought to me by this man. He sought me out very diligently and found me. The Lord granted to him that he may find mercy in the Lord in that day. There's that day again. Maybe the day when he's going to die, yeah. But there's another day here, see. The Lord grant him mercy for what he did in that day. Right? And how many times he ministered to me at Ephesus, thou knowest very well. Very interesting book. I find it extremely stimulating and challenging to my faith. This man, Onesiphorus, was not ashamed in any way to identify with Paul. Now let's go over to Demas, chapter 4, verse 10. Demas has forsaken me. He mentions this man, and not much is said about him, but there's enough said about him to realize that we're all vulnerable at any stage in our Christian life. Demas is mentioned but three times in Scripture. Colossians 4:14, Philemon 24, and here. It's very interesting. We know nothing of his conversion, but we know he was a Christian. That's obvious, because he was a companion of Paul. Paul would not have had a man who was not a Christian with him. So Demas was a Christian. He doesn't appear in the book of Acts, but the way Paul mentions him in Colossians, chapter 4:14, he would have been in the group and part of the group of a dedicated men that moved with Paul. I believe he's mentioned over here in Colossians 4:14 with Luke, the beloved physician. And Demas are together and with Paul. These three people. So I take immediately that Demas was a man who naturally was converted. But a man who not only was converted, but who was in communion and companionship with some of the most dedicated men of his time, Paul and Luke and other men. He was also a traveling companion, and he had been in more places than we care to know, that we know. We know nothing of where he started, we know nothing of his end, but just piecing it together, he was with Luke and he was with Paul, and they were traveling and they were moving around, and Demas was part of that. In Philemon 24, Paul calls him a fellow worker. Now, you know that's something, because you know how hard-nosed Paul was. When Mark turned back, Paul said to Barnabas, forget him. He washed out once, he'll wash out again. If he wants to go to a Bible camp, send him to a Bible camp. But this is the mission field. Okay? If you want to train him on a corner, train him on a corner. But we're out on the front lines. See? Paul was a hard nose when it came to workers. Philemon 24, he says, Demas is a fellow worker. That coming from Paul is a compliment. The man had demonstrated abilities. He had been with Luke and with Paul. He had traveled. He had demonstrated abilities. He had worked in such a way that he had actually suffered. He's a fellow worker. He had been working with Paul, and he had been sweating with Paul, and there was enough testimony and identity to understand that. And in fact, when Paul writes in Colossians 4:14 and says, Luke, the beloved physician, and Demas are with me, he wouldn't have mentioned Demas if the people there wouldn't have known of him. Why mention somebody they don't know? Luke and Heine Manush are with me. Well, who's Heine Manush? Say, by the way, he was a, believe it or not, an old third baseman for the Detroit Tigers in the 20s. He won the batting crown three times in the 20s. And look it up in the book. He had a great lifetime average. If he batted something like .356, if he batted that today, he'd get $10 million for 5 years. His lifetime average, .356. Anyway, he had to know the man. See? He writes to the people in Colossae, and they know the man. See what I'm getting at? I'm trying to build all this up. The man had done something. He had been used. It had been recognized. His life had been dedicated. His life was part of a movement. His life was part of a service. His life was given to God. Other people knew about it. The people at Colossae knew about it. Paul knew about it. Luke knew about it. Timothy knew about it because he mentions it in this letter to Timothy. Timothy must personally know the man. So you see, there are some conclusions I'd like to draw. Number one, he was an approved worker. As we call today, a condemned worker, a commended worker. He was an approved worker. Paul would not have accepted anybody who was not approved. So that means the man had proven himself and proven his ability to serve, and he was an approved fellow worker with Paul. Number two, he traveled in Paul's company and in Luke's company. He was surrounded by some of the most dedicated hearts and minds of his time, of all time perhaps. And yet he failed. When he was faced with the decision, he weighed out, he found his heart to weigh out the advantages or the disadvantages of being openly identified with Paul. It said, Demas, verse 10, has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and have departed into Thessalonica. See, he was an approved worker. He traveled with some of the best men, the best minds, the best hearts in church history. And he turned back. Paul says, Demas has forsaken me. Let me give you a translation from Kenneth Wiest. Here's Kenneth Wiest, and he's fairly accurate. For Demas let me down, having set a high value upon this present age, and thus has come to love it. For Demas let me down, having set a high value upon this present age, and thus has come to love it. This is very interesting. All of the men mentioned through here must have been men who worked. They must have been men who were known. See, something happened. One of the things I'm trying to say tonight is this, is that we can never stop giving our hearts to the Lord. Never. We're shocked when we find out a man or woman of God, people who walk with the Lord have turned back. We're shocked at that. We ought not be. Because at every stage of our life, we are vulnerable to something. See, we are open to something. We ought not be shocked when we hear that somebody who has served the Lord as Demas and traveled with Paul and been a fellow worker and had moved around the empire is now running to save his neck. We ought not be shocked. Because we are all faced with decisions where we are. You ever not speak up for Christ because you thought maybe if you just said something for Christ over here, maybe the people who heard it were just in a kind of position where you weighed out the advantages and disadvantages, see? No. I don't want those guys on my back, see? Or maybe there's somebody over here who you know is another Christian and you witness and you're thinking, I wonder if they're listening, man. Way out everything. This is what happened here. I did it. I mean, I just do it. I was faced with this many times in the mission field. Many, many times. I'm a North American, and they don't like North Americans. That's three strikes against you already. And I weighed out many decisions. I find myself thinking, weighing. So look at Demas. What happened? I believe a situation arose that tested Demas and threatened his very life, his very neck, his very skin. It seems obvious he went through trials before this, didn't it? If he traveled with Paul, if he traveled with Luke, he went through trials before. He was always under some kind of pressure. You see, he was always under something. Another situation comes and now see. He's under it again. Every day is a fresh walk with the Lord, folks. Every day. Our dedication is tested every day. And every day is a new walk with Him. A new time where I say He is able to keep that which I've committed to Him against that day. Whether it be my soul or whether it be chickening out against the day when I will be tested to back down. He is able to keep me. And this is what we need. Open our hearts. It can happen. And if you read 2 Timothy carefully, none of these people are mentioned. Paul mentions everybody that Timothy would know in a certain circle and a certain group of men. There's just no way he would throw in a bunch of names that are meaningless to Timothy. And that's why even the men mentioned in chapter 1 and 2, chapter 1, verse 15, Phygellus and Hermogenes, we know nothing about them. They must have been part of the group. They must have been known somehow as part of a certain group of people and a certain way of thinking. The apostles traveled before this, certainly had not been sightseeing tours, and Demas had known something of the victory of God. But every day is a new victory. And every day is a new test. Another question is, of course, have we placed too high of a value on this world? Demas has forsaken me, having loved this world. He didn't deny the Lord. Doesn't say he denied the Lord. Doesn't say that he said, I no longer believe in Christ and I'm going back and I'm going to write a book exposing evangelical Christians as being radical right politically bunch of newt-nickels. See? He didn't appear on some talk show in Canada and make mockery of the fact that he had once been a famous evangelist. It just simply says this, that when he weighed out the situation, he decided that he loved his life more. And he left. Yes, he denied the Lord in a situation, but I believe Demas went away being as much of a believer after as he was before. He simply looked at it and said, I am not willing to pay the price right now. I'm not willing to do it right now. And he left. So Demas didn't turn against Christ. He loved his own life. Another thing. Being surrounded by dedicated people is not enough. He was surrounded, as I've said twice, by the most dedicated minds and hearts in all church history, perhaps. And that wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to travel in the company of great people, to associate with great people, to work with great people, to listen to great people. There comes a time when hearts must decide alone. And in our daily life, that is where we have to decide. In our hearts and alone. And then we're going to know where our hearts really are. The whole gist of what I'm getting at tonight is this. The whole thing I really want to say is basically this. In a nutshell, it is possible to love the Lord and to be tested later on, to sacrifice, to turn against Him in some small way because we feel that it's at our disadvantage to be open. There is never any stage we reach in our Christian life where we're free from the enemy exposing what our hearts really are. And so 2 Timothy is good. I like it. I find it's an easy book to understand, but reading it slowly and reading it many times over the years, I've begun to see this picture put together. An older man talking to a younger man. An older man who has fought the fight and finished his course, and a younger man who has worked, who has done something, but now is in a place where, again, his heart's tested. And he's weighing it out. He's tested again. Is it worth going on? And Paul is writing to him and using examples of people who have found it worth going on and people who have not found it worth going on and have turned their backs. and even encourage them. God will bring situations into our lives, and I believe more often than we think, that will expose our hearts and bring us to the place where we realize how often we measure out the circumstances to see how favorable they might be before we take an open stand for them. And don't forget this, being surrounded by dedicated people will not meet the needs of our hearts when we're alone with Him.